This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and I wanted to continue to consider the writings of writers who are also gardeners. And these are two British women who couldn't be more different from one another in some respects. Vita Sackville West was tall and aristocratic. She'd stride out in her garden, and her letters to Virginia Woolf about plants and about literature have been published in a thick book that is very charming. She's described by her husband. Her eyebrows were heavy, her eyes were dark, her cheeks had a vivid carmine tinge, and she made no effort to disguise the perceptible mustache, which Virginia Woolf mentions. She was dressed in long earrings and a lacy shirt, heavy corduroy jacket, gamekeeper's breeches, top boots laced up to the knee, Lady Chatterley and her lover rolled into one. Writing for The Observer was not a new departure into a field she had yet to conquer. Her first gardening column had appeared in the Evening Standard, entitled Notes on a Late Spring. She published a book called Some Flowers, and I would like then to contrast her with Gertrude Jekyll. There couldn't be a more stark contrast. Gertrude Jekyll was dumpy and fat. Here's a description of her. In 1897, not long after Lady Emily, daughter of the first Earl of Lytton, married Edward Lutyens, England's most promising young architect, he wrote to a friend about one of her husband's colleagues. Mr. Lutyens calls her Bumps, and it's a very good name. She's very fat, stumpy, and dresses rather like a man. Little tiny eyes, very nearly blind, and big spectacles. She is simply fascinating. And Gertrude Jekyll had started out wanting to be an artist, and her eyesight became so bad that her palette had to become the garden. And she didn't really start writing and designing gardens for people until she was 54 years old and living alone, except for six cats, or sometimes 14, on Munstead Heath in England. She turned English planting design on its head, nor would she induce her country's aristocracy, the landed gentry, to repudiate the broad effects of systematic scenic idiom. All lines and triangles had been brought to its dubious glory a century before. The passage on Vita and her riding boots could be contrasted by quite a famous painting of Gertrude Jekyll's gardening boots, and the artist said that he would rather paint Gertrude Jekyll's gardening boots than a portrait of the finest person imaginable. She wrote at one point a gardener's credo, and this will give you a feeling for her emphasis. Gertrude Jekyll, 1843 to 1932, began as a painter, then turned to garden design and writing in midlife, publishing her first book at 56 and writing another dozen before she died at 89. But she was always a gardener. Intensely curious about the natural world, she brought an artistic vision to her gardens, emphasizing color and texture. She spent most of her life in Surrey, England, particularly Munstead Wood, where she ran a garden and plant breeding center. In all, she designed over 400 gardens, many of which are now restored and open to the public. Her credo, as inspiring today as it was when it was written, comes from an introductory chapter to her first book, Wood and Garden, Notes and Thoughts. I lay no claim either to literary ability or to botanical knowledge or even knowing the best practical methods of cultivation, but I have lived among outdoor flowers for many years and have not spared myself in any way the actual labor and have come to be on close, intimate, and friendly terms with a great many growing things and have acquired a certain instincts, though not clearly defined, are of the nature of useful knowledge. But the lesson I have thoroughly learned and wish to pass on to others is to know the enduring happiness that the love of a garden gives. I rejoice when I see one, and especially children inquiring about flowers and wanting gardens of their own and carefully working in them. For the love of gardening is a seed that once sown never dies, but always grows and grows to an enduring and ever-increasing source of happiness. If in the following chapters I've laid special stress upon gardening for beautiful effect, it is because it is the way of gardening I love best and know most about, and that seems to me capable of giving the greatest amount of pleasure. I am strongly for treating garden and wooded ground in a pictorial way, mainly with large effects, and in the second place with lesser beautiful incidents. And so for arranging plants and trees in grassy spaces that look happy and at home and make no parade of conscious effort. I try for beauty and harmony everywhere, especially harmony of color. A garden so treated gives the delightful feeling of repose and refreshment and purest enjoyment of beauty that seems, to my understanding, to be the best fulfillment of its purpose. While to the diligent worker, its happiness is like offering the constant hymn of praise. For I hold that the best purpose of a garden is to give delight and give refreshment of mind, and to soothe, and to refine, and to lift up the heart in a spirit of praise and thankfulness. It is certain that those who practice gardening in the best way find it to be so. But the scope of practical gardening covers a range of horticultural practice wide enough to give play to every variety of human taste. Some find their greatest pleasure in collecting as large a number as possible of all sorts of plants from all sources, others in collecting them in their foreign homes, others in making rock gardens, ferneries or peat gardens, bog gardens or gardens for conifers, for flowering shrubs or special gardens of plants and trees with variegated colored leaves, or in the cultivation of some particular race of family plants. Others may best like wide lawns with large trees, wild gardening, or a quite formal garden with a trim hedge and walk and terrace and brilliant parterre, or a combination of several ways of gardening, and all are right and reasonable and enjoyable to their owners and in some way or degree helpful to others. The way that seems most desirable is again different, and I have made an attempt to describe in some aspects, but I've learned much and am always learning from other people's gardens. And the lesson I have learned most thoroughly is to never say, I know. There is so infinitely much to learn, and conditions of different gardens vary so greatly when soil and situation appear to be alike and they are in the same district. Nature is such a subtle chemist that one never knows what she's about or what surprises she may have in store for us. Often one sees in gardening papers discussions about the treatment of some particular plant. One man writes to say it can be done only one way, another to say it can be done only in quite a different way, and the discussion waxes hot and almost angry, and the puzzled reader, perhaps, as yet young in gardening, cannot tell what to make of it. And yet the two writers are both able gardeners and both absolutely trustworthy. Only they should have said, in my experience, in this place, such a plant can be done only in such a way. Even plants of the same family will not do equally well in the same garden. Every practical gardener knows this. It is the case of strawberries and potatoes. He has to find out which kinds will do in his garden. The experience of his friend in the next county is probably of no use whatsoever. I have learned much from little cottage gardens that help to make our English waysides the prettiest in the temperate world. One can hardly go into the smallest cottage garden without learning or observing something new. It may be some two plants growing beautifully together, and by some happy chance, a pretty mixed tangle of creepers or something one always thought must have a south wall doing better on an east one. But eye and brain must be alert to receive the impression and studious to store it and add to the hoard of experience. It is impossible to train oneself to have a good flower eye, to be able to see at a glance what flowers are good and which are unworthy, and keep an open mind about it, not to be swayed by the petty tyrannies of the florist or the show judge. For though some part of his judgment may be sound, he himself is a slave to rules and must go by points which are defined arbitrarily and rigidly and have reference mainly to the show table, leaving out of account, as if unworthy of consideration, such matters as gardens and garden beauty and human delight and sunshine and varying lights of morning and evening and noonday. Let no one be discouraged by the thought of how much there is to learn. Looking back on 30 years of gardening, the earlier part of it in groping ignorance with scant means of help, I can remember no part of it that was not full of pleasure and encouragement. For the first steps are into a delightful unknown. The first successes are victories, all the happier for being scarcely expected. And with the growing knowledge that comes from widening outlook and the comforting sense of an ever-increasing gain of critical appreciation, each new step becomes a little surer, each new grasp a little firmer, till little by little there comes the power of intelligent combination, the nearest thing that we can know to the mighty force of creation. And a garden is a grand teacher. It teaches patience and careful watchfulness. It teaches industry and thrift. Above all, it teaches entire trust. Paul planteth and Apollos watereth, but God giveth increase. The good gardener knows with absolute certainty that if he does his part, if he gives his labor, the love and every aid that his knowledge of his craft, experiencing the conditions of the place, and exercise the personal wit that can work together to suggest that so surely as he does this diligently and faithfully, so surely God will give increase. Then with the honestly earned success comes the consciousness of encouragement to renewed effort, and as it were, the echo of the gracious words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." That gives you a feeling for Gertrude Jekyll. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.